Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe.
And I'm Justin.
We got another What's New For You, what came out in April 2025. And, sorry in advance, we didn't get to see very many movies this month. But I watched a lot of TV, and Justin watched some TV and audiobooks, and let's run down the list for you so you know what we're going to be talking about today. No major spoilers in these, but we are talking about premises for the plots, so if you're the kind of person that's too much spoilers, and some plot points probably in the middle as well. Basically, we're not covering any third act twists, but we are talking about plots in general here. Today, we are covering Daredevil, Born Again, Otherworldly, The Amateur, Black Mirror, Season 7, Solo Leveling, Season 2, was it? Light and Magic, Season 2, and some general news in April, which is mostly just what trailers we watched. Let's get into this now with Daredevil, Born Again.
Born Again.
As you have predicted for many, many years before we even got to this. Because you did not like the original Daredevil.
It's boring.
Yeah, let's get that hot take out of the way. It's one of my favorite shows of all time.
It's boring.
It's slow burn. And I was in strong anticipation for this series for many, many years. I was heartbroken when they canceled the first run of Daredevil on Netflix. Thought they never should have canceled it. Very extra bitter when I heard this show was even coming out because it was called Born Again. And I'm like, you adapted the Born Again plot for season 3 of the Netflix show. This is just a shameless marketing cash grab. But you got Charlie Cox back, you got Vincent D'Onofrio back, and okay, it's a Daredevil content, I'm gonna watch it. But then there was the controversy that came out about it, where they were most of the way through production during COVID. They were about 6 episodes in when the writers and actors strike happened, and Kevin Feige and co. got to take a look at what was already produced, and they didn't like it. So they basically scrapped it, and when the strikes ended, they started from scratch. And, well, not quite from scratch, because they did keep as much as they possibly could, but they rewrote it from the ground up to try and fit in as much of the old stuff as possible. And a lot of times it does feel like a patchwork show, because, well, first of all, there's an entire episode in here that was done by the old crew. They actually kept an entire one, and that's one of the best ones, personally.
Oh, that's not a good sign.
The thing about this show is it is very good episodic television for its 9 episodes. I was surprised with how they managed to make every episode feel like a standalone adventure. But, I mean, you jokingly call it Born Again, but you don't go into this show expecting much Daredevil action, because he's basically Matt Murdock, the lawyer, for at least half the show. That's the entire point of why they called this one Born Again, because he's given up being Daredevil, and Kingpin has given up being Kingpin, and they're basically spending this show in denial of what they really should be doing. Wilson Fisk has gone legit. He's the new mayor of New York City, and he's on a crusade to wipe out all vigilantes by any means necessary. And he starts getting progressively sketchier in the avenues he takes to get there. Meanwhile, Matt Murdock is feeling like he can't be Daredevil because he morally compromised himself, and he doesn't want to put that suit again and let the devil out, because he's worried he's going to cross some lines if he actually does it. But he's slowly getting pushed back into, with Wilson Fisk as mayor, and getting sketchier as time goes on, and Matt seeing all this injustice around him that he can't solve as a lawyer, because he tries to do things the legal way by the system. So it's kind of a twofold thing. We're seeing Matt try to follow the system, and we're seeing Wilson Fisk try to follow the system. But Fisk is naturally a criminal and starts pushing the system past the point of playing fair. And Matt being the lawyer in an unfair system can't win either. So these guys are slowly coming to a convergence as the series goes. Matt's like, well, pretty much the only way to make the system fair is if I go vigilante again and, you know, let the devil out, like I said before. And Wilson Fisk is like, well, the only way to do what I want is basically do it illegally too, because the system isn't working for me. I'm mayor of New York City and I still can't do what I want without having to coerce all these counselors and the elite of the city who look down on him as this blue-collar, self-made man. At least that's how he sees himself. So it's all about these power plays in New York City and trying to work in a broken system, legally specifically, but politically as well. And the acting's phenomenal. I mean, Charlie Cox and Vincent D'Onofrio, they were the linchpin that held the old show together, and they're still in top form here, despite very little action. But where this show starts falling flat is with its new supporting cast, because there were a lot of characters in here where I thought, well, why didn't you just get somebody from the old show, like Karen or Foggy or the... I forget his name now, but the character who was a friend of Matt's on the police force as well, that seemed like a good avenue for him to be in here. But we have this entire new cast of supporting characters in Matt Murdock's life, and the other ones are just nowhere to be found for most of the season. Which, I understand the way they were doing this show is part of the point, because Matt feels very isolated. He's let his old life burn bridges behind him. And he's moved on to a status quo that feels similar, but just off. And like I feel like that's the idea. It's supposed to feel, okay, so he's still doing lawyer stuff and starting to want to do vigilante stuff, but it's just not the same. And that's the kind of string that Matt starts to follow towards rebuilding his status quo as we know it. But you also see how him trying to rebuild that status quo and start dabbling into vigilantism again is blowing up his life pretty effectively. Every time he takes a step towards becoming Daredevil again, his sense of normalcy and stability starts to crumble. Being a vigilante is not good for him, but it also completes him spiritually. So it's very... Same thing with Wilson Fisk. Being a criminal is not the best choice for him right now, but also he can't help it, and it fulfills him. So it is very interesting series, incredible filmmaking as well. I love the color choices and the cinematography. It looks very... It's one of Marvel's best-looking shows on TV. They overused some CGI for my tastes. The combat choreography, when there was combat choreography, the editing was too quick around, personally, or the scenes were too dark, or the presentation of the fights was definitely not as good as the old show, for a fact. But, what else? Yeah, that's...
So... Is it worth it for somebody who never watched the original show and doesn't really know anything about Daredevil?
No. No, it's technically being billed as a new show, but it's very much season 4 of the old show, playing on the relationship dynamics that we already knew from the old show. Even the way it starts is very much, why would I care about this if I didn't know the old show and the old characters already? So... It is Daredevil season 4, and it does set up a really good Born Again season 2. It ends very strong, but it also ends in a way that I'm like, well, I kind of wanted to see that the entire time.
So it's a very typical of Disney Plus TV shows.
They give you a first season that's like, well, this whole season's just to set up the thing you wanted to see all along.
It's the lead up to what we're going to do.
Exactly. Which... Once again, as a critic of the filmmaking. I thought it was very well handled. The only thing is it looks a little too clean, I'd say. The old series had grime and grit basically coming out of the screen. They made Hell's Kitchen feel like a real dirty, awful place to live. And once again, maybe that's part of the idea that this is a new status quo, a new New York, and it feels cleaner visually. But it just, the dichotomy between the old show and this one, it's like, okay, this one looks more expensive, but it also feels a bit more sanitized.
So it's a Hollywood Western versus a spaghetti Western?
Yeah, in visuals, in terms of a visual comparison, yeah. Although they did, when I do say sanitized, they didn't skimp on the violence, for a fact. When the violence shows up, it's bloody, it's brutal, nearly even more brutal than the original. There's this one specific scene near the end of the show where I'm like, oh, this is on Disney Plus? Wow, that's the most violent thing I've ever seen on this platform. Okay. But overall, I had my disappointments with it, but Born Again is pretty darn good on the whole. The biggest problem with it is that they drag this basically predetermined conclusion out over 9 episodes. Daredevil and Kingpin realizing what they're meant to do. We kind of know where it's going very early, but it took 9 episodes to get there. And those 9 episodes as individual packages, you can watch them, you can enjoy them. It is good episodic television. It just feels like a letdown as a complete package is my biggest problem. But overall, Born Again is pretty darn good.
Sounds to me like something I'll put on if I need to fall asleep.
As long as you're watching it, you know? That's all Disney wants, is them clicks.
I guess the click counts.
Yeah.
Dang.
So you got Otherworldly, which I don't know about at all.
So it's Otherworldly. It's by Lee Bacon. It came out like 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think. Essentially, think of a modern Disney animated movie, how they're all basically the same. Mm-hmm. They've all got like, and then do that, but E.T. Okay. And you already know what you're going into. Just remake E.T. as a modern animated Disney movie, and you've got this book.
I see.
I don't think I'm the target audience. I kind of know where the target audience is, so I'm going into it like for that audience, basically, is how I'm kind of going to review it, because I know I'm not the target audience.
Which would be what, in your estimation?
Probably like, I don't know, mid-teens, maybe even lower, like 15 is probably the target audience, I would say.
Okay, teen fiction.
Or maybe even lower. So, the biggest problem I had with this was the two main characters, they're best friends, they're doing a podcast, right?
Why are they looking into our lives?
Because they're best friends. They're very similar characters, right? They share the same things. They're very similar. Which would be fine if they didn't cast two voice actors who sound almost identical. So you sit there, and when you're listening to this in an audiobook format, you kind of lose track of which character is which, who's saying what, who's got what going on, because the characters are near identical, how they're written, and they sound identical. So those characters constantly get, you flip back and forth and you're like, which character just went somewhere else? What character's doing this? So that was pretty confusing. And overall, like, I think the message behind, like, it's got a message. That's what it's there for. It's interesting enough. It's a pretty stereotypical story. That's the thing, is this story's been done a lot of times. It's nothing original. And it has enough flaws in an audiobook format that I think it should have been done better.
Mm-hmm.
If it was done well as an audio, like, this is an audiobook exclusive. There's no physical book for this. So it was designed as an audiobook. And it's kind of cool because they're like, oh yeah, we're making a podcast. And that's the reason why we have an audio format, is they're podcasting the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of neat that there's a bit of a reason why it's an audio thing. So it's got its perks, but it's just, it's a worn out story that's not done well enough in an audio format, even for its target audience. I think for children's media to teenagers media should still be well done. The stories, yes, the stories, I know, you know, children's media has gone downhill and the stories are a bit weaker nowadays. But the production value, they still try with stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This, I find, the glaring issues make it that it's like, okay, even for the target audience, I don't think they would enjoy this. Just because it's of the way they've done the format. I'm not sure what I would give this. It's mid-tier garbage, I guess.
It sounds like a case of missed potential.
Yeah. Like, it'd be solid, like, mid-tier garbage.
If the presentation were better.
If it was, yeah, done correctly as an audiobook, and I'm not sure how this glaring issue got through so many eyes, or ears, technically, to get to this point where it's like, oh, okay, this is what you did. All right. I'm not sure why that ended up like that. But, it's a little below mid-tier garbage. I'll place it at mid-tier garbage, but it's almost just terrible. Don't even bother.
So not really a recommend, but it's not bad enough that it'll ruin your time if you chose to watch.
No, it's not like, you know,
listen in the background sort of thing.
Yeah. If you got nothing else, sure. It's not terrible, but.
Okay.
Mid-tier garbage. That's what that rating is for.
Okay. So, do you want to move on to The Amateur?
Yep.
All right. So, my thing on The Amateur, I think it pads out a repetitive plot and only has basically its technical filmmaking skills, which save it from outright mediocrity. It's a worse version of Novocaine, which
that's you can really hear what us, I thought too.
You can hear us talk about Novocaine on the last podcast, which the last What's New, rather, which I know we're talking about The Amateur, but I don't, in comparison to Novocaine, that made me appreciate Novocaine
even more
for what it did very well. That is a movie which, in my estimation, has gone up in the last month. Especially when you compare it to something like The Amateur, which is a very, very similar plot with a far worse execution.
See, I thought it was very interesting because I talked to my dad about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his girlfriend thought The Amateur was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, maybe it was part of that bias that we had just seen this, not the exact same movie, but a very similar premise done much, much better.
Yeah, we're on the same page about this one. But I think in terms of its filmmaking, a lot of it was done pretty well. I liked a lot of the point of view surveillance shots that were sprinkled throughout the movie. All those camera shots, like of security cameras or other things like that, that are basically showing characters or giving us expositional information just from a technology's point of view. I thought those were cool elements to it. I also liked the montages when he's actually doing some digital forensic investigating, when he's taking the information and IDing the killers and of his wife based on where they are or the sounds he can hear or just tracking down who these people are with the breadcrumbs. I really like that stuff in the first act.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Or also later on, I guess it was near the end of the first act, when the CIA is trying to track him down too.
Mm-hmm.
When he leaves all those breadcrumbs for them to follow as well.
He knows the system extremely well. I will give it that. They made him as a character, like, you kind of knew who he was right away.
Yeah.
And they did that really well, setting him up as a character and exactly what to expect going through, which was good.
I thought it was... One thing I liked about the presentation of his character was they didn't outright say he had OCD, but I could definitely see some OCD coding in there. Even from the very first bit when he's making his wife coffee and he takes a teaspoon and he, you know, brushes off the teaspoon to make an exact measurement on it. And I'm like, just the little details like that. And I was never swayed from that opinion that I'm like, Rami Malek is playing this character like he's got OCD tendencies.
Even every time he's got papers, he compulsively is like,
yeah,
they've got to be squared off. And
yeah. I didn't notice that one in particular, but there were just a couple ones where I'm like, yeah, the movie's not telling me this. It may not even be in the script, but Rami Malek's playing it that way.
Well, definitely, like, first act, how he smuggled the document out was due to his compulsion, essentially. His need for perfection made it so that when he put that thing on his ID card, nobody saw it. Nobody, even through the x-ray, they didn't catch it because it was so precisely
placed. Yes. I thought the movie got exponentially better when Lawrence Fishburne showed up. He got all the best lines in the movie.
I was glad to see that he stuck around later. I thought he was going to be one and done, but mm-hmm. That was... Yeah, he makes the movie good.
Everyone else is very... Like, Rami Malek is a very... You know, he's just kind of this nerdy guy and he's very hell-bent on his vengeance quest, but he's not super overflowing with personality. Lawrence Fishburne is a good counter for this nerdy tech guy who's actually a very confident CIA agent, and he kind of pokes him a little bit and he's just more emotionally dynamic than basically anybody else in the movie, and he gets the best lines. So he's just the most entertaining to watch.
Now, what did you think about Rami Malek's acting with his wife at the beginning?
What you're getting at is that I didn't necessarily feel the chemistry like crazy, but I understood the point. Like, okay, this is his wife and happy marriage and okay.
I think that threw me off right at the beginning, that it was just like, His acting felt so wooden and stiff that it was like...
I think he's a very good facial actor. I think... I don't necessarily look at the way he's communicating with his entire body, but his whole performance is in his face at all times. And I think he does a very good job at that.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be watching him closely the entire time to see the subtleties.
Yeah. I mean, like, the further we got into the movie, the more I really bought into his character, and it was good. But I just think he didn't sell me at the beginning on the like, he didn't feel like he cared about his wife
at all. Not enough for the rest of the movie.
No, and I think that was a problem I had with it, too.
The first act of The Amateur didn't really make me care about the central relationship, and it was slow. As well, it took forever before he finally got on this quest of his.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like a lot of the things they were setting up either could have been done later or just cut out of the movie entirely.
Well, I believe my dad said that this was a remake. Did you know that?
I did not.
Apparently it was a remake, and I think it was at the beginning with the CIA kind of conspiracy was never really a part of it. That was all kind of new to the story.
I see.
So you're saying, you're like, oh yeah, you know, it might have been better if it was cut out. As far as I understand, that was an addition to the story.
Now, when they talked about it originally in the story, I was intrigued by it. I'm like, oh, okay, this is actually kind of cool. I'm looking forward to this, seeing how that unravels. And it wasn't bad. It just padded the movie and pulled focus from where I thought the focus should have been. It would have been a more streamlined movie if you just cut that part out of it. Or stop cutting back to the CIA guys the entire time. Which, you know, I liked the main villain. He was a smarmy prick and he was also fun to watch. But it just wasn't unnecessary, really.
It just took its sweet time to get through things.
Yeah. And it wasn't... I'm okay with things taking their sweet time if I'm intellectually stimulated or generally entertained. And I didn't really get enough of either, so it just felt slow.
Yeah, that's... Like, Novocaine...
Tight, lean.
Even though it really took its time, it was very slow at the beginning. But it kept your attention. I was ready to watch this romantic comedy.
Yeah, I was invested.
And I just think that was something that was missing from this one. Is it just, even though it took its time, it just didn't keep my attention.
It lacked momentum. I think one problem with a lot of movies is you need a ticking clock sometimes. A lot of times, really, you need there to be a consequence for taking too long to get to the point. It's the classic Alfred Hitchcock thing about if you see two guys having a conversation, that's one thing. Next layer on top of that, you see two guys having a conversation. Oh, we cut to a bomb under the table with a timer on it. Oh, great. And then the third layer is we have the two guys having a conversation. We know there's a bomb under the table and there's a clock in the background. And suddenly a conversation gets intense. Just with that information, there's a bomb under the table, we see a countdown, and we see a clock in the background. This kind of movie doesn't have that sort of momentum. Like Novocaine, for example, if we're playing comparison games, it had that momentum. If he doesn't do this right now, the guys who robbed the bank and kidnapped his girlfriend are gonna get away.
Yeah.
Rami Malek's main character there doesn't...
He really didn't have a reason to keep pushing. There were actually points where he actually had the chance to slow down.
And there was no time limit. These bad guys are going to continue to operate. He might be able to find them. I mean, it lacked momentum. So it felt like it could plod and take its time a little bit longer without being that interesting.
I don't want to go that deep into spoilers, but the ending disappointed me.
Yeah,
it fell flat, I think. I don't want to go into it too much, but...
It was just sort of, we're going, okay.
Yeah.
That's an ending, I guess.
It's an ending, I guess, yeah.
It doesn't ruin it or anything, it's just, could have been more...
I mean, maybe I would have been more impressed, because it was kind of on a roll for a bit, and then... If it pulled off the ending, it would probably get a better rating from me, but... I'd probably call it it's a snack movie. It's a
watch passively as well.
Yeah, go get up. You don't pause when you go to the washroom. You just get up and go get a snack. Come back. It's just a mid-tier garbage. Basically, it's going to fall into obscurity
very quickly.
Very quickly.
Just watch Novocaine. That's what it comes down to. That if you get anything from this review, just watch Novocaine instead. If you want something similar,
it's not the same premise, but it's just
it's similar enough and it's done better.
Yeah.
Basically, my point is the story and the execution are weak, but the filmmaking is better than average for something like this.
Like, the set pieces were all pretty cool.
Yeah, like, it was well edited, like, the fights were choreographed. Like, it was well done in most regards. It was just, I think the script is what mostly lets it down. It's just too padded. And doesn't have the momentum. So that is The Amateur. Next up for me is Black Mirror, Season 7, which it's unfortunate you haven't been able to catch up on Black Mirror yet, but I'd say Black Mirror Season 7 showcases moving, though uneven, sci-fi portraits of human connections through technologies. That is the big theme I noticed this year. Was pretty much every story had to do with building human connection through technology. Like, I also noticed there was a lot of technology connecting with people's brains that basically happened in every single episode this season, was there was some kind of technology that hooked right into your brain and did something or other. Sometimes it was to help heal your brain from an illness. Other times it put you in a virtual world. Other times it was connecting with other devices. Other times it was connecting with other people. But just the idea of technology and people being in symbiosis, connections were the theme of the year. But a lot of these times it led to deeper connections with other human beings through this technology.
I wonder if that's in contrast because the previous season kind of dealt with more things away from technology.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
I wonder if that's why, like, you know, that season was more collected the way it was with less technology involved.
That one got flat out supernatural sometimes, yeah, this last season.
And then now we've gone into the technology season.
Yeah. I wasn't really watching other seasons maybe as critically because I didn't pick up on general overarching themes in season 6. But now that you mention it, they were less, you know, we got like Demon 76, the werewolf one, just less technologically focused, more supernatural, mm-hmm. which I thought was interesting at the time. But yeah, I thought these stories were mostly pretty good. They're not all amazing. There's only a couple in here that really blew me away. I loved the eulogy one with Paul Giamatti, which I'll just describe a little bit just because that's one that really stood out to me. So basically in that one, Paul Giamatti, he gets a box from a company called Eulogy, and it's for the funeral of this ex-girlfriend of his from that they broke up and dated 40 years ago. But the daughter is getting some of her old her mother's old acquaintances to do this eulogy thing, where basically you have a thing that connects to your brain, and this AI walks you through memories of your time with that person and picks out the best ones to put in a eulogy slideshow, basically. But he had a bad relationship with this girl because it ended a long time ago very badly, so the AI is like, okay, well, we can't use any of these memories, and that's bad, and that's bad, and okay, let's try to find something nice in here.
So is the AI like a person?
It's a representation.
Okay.
Of a person at some point. And part of his problem is he can't remember the girl's face because every picture he has of her is intentionally like cut out or burnt out. And he went very hardcore on cutting out all memories of this woman for so long that he's forced to recollect. And he's like, I actually want to remember her, but I'm having a lot of trouble because I tried so long to forget. And as that one goes, the AI sort of breaks down. You know, I can see why this relationship ended. Everything he's starting to remember gives a clue as to how that relationship played out the way it did, and it's just really cool to see unfold. I also really like the first one where Rashida Jones has a tumor in her brain, and then they take that out and put a piece of technology in there to basically clone that part of her brain, and it's connected to this subscription service network, basically, where her brain's like a cell tower. She can only go in at a certain range before her brain stops working. But the problem with that one is it's a really expensive subscription fee that she and her husband have to work their butts off to pay constantly just so that she stays alive. Because at first, it seems like a pretty good deal. Oh, well, she's definitely going to die or be in a vegetative state if we don't use this technology. But then the fact that she's still alive, they're working harder than ever before and losing their tranquil life just to pay the bills for her brain chip every month.
Now, I've heard quite a bit about this one, but does it deal into the idea of it being like, well, technically this is just bonus time, she would have been dead anyways?
A little bit.
Or does that kind of defeat the message they were going for with that one?
It deals with it ever so slightly, but it's more of a subtextual thing that you as the viewer bring to it. It's more like, yeah, maybe she was better off dead. Just in what you're seeing, you're like, well, their lives may have been easier if he just let her die when the doctor said that was it. But of course, you're kind of being walked along this. Of course, if you have a technology that could save her, why wouldn't you do that? But then it just made their lives harder. And in the end, she, you know, it's makes it harder to the point where it takes something away from her life that she wasn't expecting. It just made life harder to live. So that was a very good one. I have some mixed feelings about the middle ones. I did really like the one with Peter Capaldi as well, where he's basically, everyone thinks he's this crazy guy. That one was a sequel to Bandersnatch, actually. Or at least it was set in the same universe. There was a Will Poulter's character from Bandersnatch makes a cameo in it, and it is set in the same universe. And then there's the outright sequel to USS Callister, which I also thought was very well handled. I love the cinematography on that one, mirroring J.J. Abrams' Star Trek movies, which is a very distinct visual style that made me go, huh, cool. This is just the level of detail on this show I really appreciate. And it was a very well-done sequel, too, which arguably deepened the lore of the universe from the first one. You could just watch USS Callister 1 and 2 and get a really good continuation, just those two. And, yeah, then there was, I think it was called Bete Noir and Hotel Reverie. And those ones were good. Flawed, though. Some of them didn't make me care enough early on to really get my strong emotional investment, or the characters weren't likable enough for me to root for the entire time. So, like, but I was always intellectually interested in every one of these installments.
Well, I think that's one of Black Mirror's strengths, is because each episode is a different, can be, like, entirely different. A season has either, there's some hit episodes, or usually they end up being, like, mid-tier.
Yeah.
You know, you're somewhere in between, but usually they're always entertaining enough. They're still worth watching.
100%.
Even passively. But then you get those ones that are really good. So it's always got those high peaks, but, you know, it stays pretty consistent in the middle, too.
Yeah, let me look up the season episodes, just so I can rank each of them individually. So Common People, I think that one's a must-see. I love that one. Bete Noir was worth a watch. It was interesting. Hotel Reverie, also worth a watch. I enjoyed that one, specifically the third act of it, when it really started tying in together. Plaything was pretty darn good. Eulogy, I think that one's a watch ASAP. That one's an all-time great Black Mirror episode. And USS Callister was also pretty good. So on the whole, Black Mirror Season 7 was pretty good. I also enjoy that it was a bit more positive than other seasons. I didn't feel as bleakly depressive as usual watching Black Mirror this season. Sometimes good things happen to good people in this season.
No, it's not allowed.
They're all put through hell, but sometimes the good people win this year. And the bad people get what's coming to them. So that's not typical Black Mirror, but I appreciate it doing a little bit different. It's a bit more tonally balanced and less constant cynicism. So, yeah, that's Black Mirror. Solo Leveling.
All right. So, Solo Leveling Season 2. I talked about the first one on here, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
on a leisure list, I believe.
Yeah, somewhere I talked about it. And I said it was pretty good. So the power growth continues, essentially. We left off at an interesting point in the previous season. And it just goes up from there. This season was distinctly better than the first season, even though I really liked the first season. The second season just like topped it easily.
Excellent.
I think it came down to the character's evolution. In the first season, he's very meek and small, and he's also trying to isolate himself. He distinctly says that he's solo leveling. He's doing this by himself. And once we get into the second season, he's a lot more confident. And that is much better to watch. You know, he's not keeping everything a secret. He's not holding himself back so other people don't see things as well. So you get a lot more, he lets a lot more go. And you can see more of what he can actually do. It almost feels like the first season kind of held back on showing even the audience what he could do. So the second season, it kind of lets that all loose. And he gained a very interesting new power at the very end of the first season. And it definitely pays off in the second season. It's really cool. It makes the fights really interesting. And even the way it was done allowed them to create interesting enemies that he can defeat, but we still get to keep them around in a way so that they, you know, you don't just have this really cool bad guy and then, oh, he beat him, he's dead. All right. See you later. No. We get to keep using them. So that was really interesting because there were some interesting bad guys or, you know, creatures that he would fight that you're like, oh, you know, it might have been interesting to see these designs stick around a bit longer. Well, now they can do that. And yeah, it left it on a really good cliffhanger for the next season. I'm looking forward to it, even though I'm going to have to wait. I'm pretty sure it's pretty consistent. It'll probably be next year, I think. The other thing that was really good about this season was the intro. So typically with anime, they switch up the theme songs basically every year, sometimes even midway through a season. They'll change the whole intro thing. I don't quite get it because I'm used to having theme songs that last throughout the entirety of the show's run. But I'm starting to get it now. I'm starting to get it. So this season had a new theme song that was really, really well done. I thought it was really good. And there's a singer on the track that I immediately recognized from the first season of Demon Slayer. She's that good that you're like, immediately I'm like, oh, that's Lisa, isn't it? And I'm not like that deep into anime, but her voice is very unique and it really, I don't know, it's really catchy. You like to listen to it every time. And it just gets, it really gets you ready for the season. I thought it was really well done. And yeah, solo leveling, I definitely recommend it. It's very good.
Yeah, I do enjoy when creatures and antagonists get to come back. I think that's a big failing of a lot of modern media, is that they kill off bad guys before they can become recurring antagonists. Which, going back to Daredevil, is one of my favorite things about that series compared to other Marvel projects or DC even, is that they let Matt Murdock and Wilson Fisk have this ongoing actual superhero arch-villain rivalry spanning the last decade. These two have a long shared history, and you don't get to see that in other superhero projects because most of them would have killed off Kingpin at the end of season one. And we never see that again. But these guys just keep one-upping each other and hating each other even more. And like in the comic books that everyone loves so much, there's a reason arch-villains became a thing, is because they keep coming back and the relationships just get more complicated and more interesting over time. And I'm glad Solo Leveling takes that approach to its antagonists. Let some relationships continue and build out.
Yeah, and they also, this season, they focused less on Genu, the main character. They kind of brought in a lot of, not, they didn't bring them in. We've known about these characters, we've seen them briefly, or we've heard about them before. They were set up in the first season. And they focused a lot more on the other characters this season and let Genu's power kind of influence them in a way where we're seeing the effects of how he's kind of changing things, because he's approaching a level of power that's, you know, he used to be the very, very bottom. He was the absolute worst. He's basically at the top at the beginning of season two. We're not 100% sure if he's at the top, but you know for a fact that even getting a couple episodes in, you already know he's probably better than everybody else. And so having that significant change in power in the world really has a rippling effect across all the other characters. So it made it really interesting to follow the other characters and see how that ripple outwards kind of affected everything else.
Okay. Sounds pretty good. I will probably not be talking about Light and Magic season two very long because there wasn't a heck of a lot in there. It was only 3 episodes. Light and Magic season 2 offers biting interviews with film industry professionals, yet feels truncated. As I said, it was only 3 episodes, and that didn't feel like enough. Last season had 6, as a point of comparison. And the first 2 episodes were really good. The first one is basically all about the production of The Phantom Menace. The second one goes very strong into Attack of the Clones. But then the third one just sort of combines some years after Revenge of the Sith and starts talking about, I'd say between 2005 to 2009, they sort of just combine them. And a lot of the idea for that last episode is about the competitors springing up to ILM. They're not the only game in town anymore. A large chunk of time was talking about Weta Digital specifically and how they, ILM considered them their biggest competition. ILM refused to do, they turned down Avatar, for example, and then this other production company, Weta Digital, they snagged Avatar, just for example. And well, we all know how that went, and made $2 billion and was incredibly lauded for its special effects work. And that's a bit of a stain on ILM's record for turning that one down.
Did they go into the reasons, like, why they turned it down, or...?
They did, but I'm struggling to remember at the moment. I think it was just because they showed a tech demo of some of the Na'vi CGI by ILM in there, which I'd never seen before. Like, this is what it might have looked like if ILM done it. So they did do some pre-visualization work on it, just to see if they could do it reasonably. Maybe they just didn't feel they were up to it. I really like the first 2 episodes in particular, talking about the making of the prequels, and also other movies like The Perfect Storm or Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl. Actually, also the other 2 as well, Dead Man's Chest and At World's End.
Oh, so they went pretty far then with the timeline.
Yeah, I'd say, once again, I'd say it gets up to about 2009-ish. And I think that's my, once again, that's my problem, is I wish they had gone up to about 2012, where Lucasfilm was bought by Disney. That would have felt like...
Well, that would have been the end then, basically.
I mean, obviously, ILM kept going after that, but it's... Yeah.
But it's there's a pretty significant shift after that point.
I feel like that would have been a more apt ending for this season. You basically got just a couple years short of the Disney purchase.
It is made for Disney and kind of by Disney, like the actual... Maybe they just didn't want to go into that. I don't know.
Maybe not. I remember the last episode of ILM season one was very... I didn't like that one as much as the rest of the season because it started feeling like Disney corporate propaganda. It was very much like, okay, we're being pretty honest. And then when it gets to The Mandalorian and the sequels, it nearly felt like everyone was shutting up. And there were like these executives we hadn't seen in the documentary at that point. And they were, you know, they were talking up all the work and everything. And I just felt like this feels like a propaganda episode.
Yeah, I remember feeling the same thing when I watched it. It just didn't feel genuine. Like, it literally, you could tell, like, they did interview some of the same people, and those people felt completely different when...
That one felt weird. This one stayed arguably even more raw than the first season. What I liked about... In the first season was directed by Lawrence Kasdan, and this season was directed by Joe Johnston, who was a... I believe they interviewed him in the first season too, and it definitely showed old pictures of him in the art department as well. I liked that the interviews nearly pitted themselves against the others. Like sometimes when somebody was talking about something and the interviewer was like, okay, well, I was talking to somebody else about this and they said that. What do you think about that? And they were sort of, there was a bit more of a back and forth response to some of these things.
That also might be a case of, you know, if you're talking about the original Star Wars, you're going back like what, 40, 50 years?
Yep.
You're going to the prequels, you're talking 20 years. So the people involved will have a fresher memory of it.
That's
so
true.
Maybe they've got more to say about it and more.
Well, that's one of the funniest bits in it was when Joe Johnston was talking to George Lucas about Jar Jar Binks. There was a whole section about Jar Jar and all the work that went into making Jar Jar and the eventual backlash behind it. And George starts going into this spiel about, oh, well, when the originals came out, people hated 3PO2. And Joe Johnston's like, no, they didn't. And George just gives him this dirty look. And it was like, this guy worked on the originals, you know? And so there's a bit of more back and forth like that where there is a bit more contradiction and I think some tougher questions were asked this time and you get to feel more of the bitterness about some of the things behind the scenes. Like there was a producer, Rick McCallum, who I remember seeing on special features on prequel DVDs when I was a kid. That's the only reason I know that name at all. And everyone has a very clear professional disdain for him. They're trying very hard not to outright bash this guy, but you can tell nobody really liked him that well. And he does feature a little bit in this documentary as well. He kind of gets his say on it. Like George Lucas brought him in as the hammer on ILM. Cuts, cuts, cuts. Stay on budget, stay on time. He was just the guy everybody hated, but that was his job at the same time. So he does have... And it seems like he did his job well, but he didn't make many friends doing it. And you can tell some of the bitterness even all these years later and some of the people talking about him. And I also enjoyed seeing the other perspectives of some things, like John Knoll talking about being very insistent that the clone troopers be in practical costumes. And George Lucas shuts that down. He's like, no, I insist they be CGI in this. Or other preconceived notions, like the prequels being so chock full of CGI. Well, for example, they show some scenes where it's very clearly models. Like on Kamino, even, there were like certain walkways and whatever. Like there's a lot of CGI in there, but a lot of it is actually practical model work. or on Revenge of the Sith, they showed rivers of lava that they practically built in a giant set. And it starts to tear down these preconceived notions that the prequels were all CGI, or like there was evidently a lot of them in there, but the model shop got a lot of work to do on those too. There was a lot of practical effects that blend those. It's probably one of the first instances of people thinking there's way too much CGI in this when more of it's practical than they realized, which is a common problem in today's movies. I don't know how practical a lot of these are, but people's first gut reaction is it's CGI. Evidently, that was a problem 20 years ago, too, that they did it so well. You couldn't tell. And that was a big thing George said about Jar Jar, as an example, where he was talking about the backlash of it and how everyone hated Jar Jar, and his thing was, okay, but did anyone of these critics say that the special effects didn't look good or convincing to them? They're bashing on the character of Jar Jar, but they're so invested in the character of Jar Jar, they're not looking at him as a special effect character. They're treating him like a performance, like an actor. And George was like, I don't care about the backlash because they weren't complaining about the technology, and that's...
He was basically a tech demo in a way.
Yeah. I always say that Ahmed Best doesn't get enough credit for his pioneering work in motion capture. Everybody gives that credit to Andy Serkis for Gollum, which, incredible performance, obviously, and rightfully accoladed, but Ahmed Best did it first. Jar Jar was... I think he was the first fully CGI character who was in that much of a movie. He was basically a main character in The Phantom Menace, and it, you know, maybe it's dated 25 years later, but it still holds up reasonably well for a movie from 1999 that had a full CGI character the entire movie. And Ahmed Best did a good performance. Like, once again, people think about Jar Jar the character, not Jar Jar the tech demo special effect.
Well, he has very distinct movements. Like, it's not like they didn't build him in. Like, Ahmed Best did a good job actually doing what he was supposed to do.
Yeah, that's what he.
If you think about it, like, that's why people go and they're like, oh yeah, Gollum was so good, because the motion capture really added to that unique movement style that he does as Gollum.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, he did, Ahmed Best did the same thing with Jar Jar in the same way. He had a very distinct style. Like, you could imitate walking around like Jar Jar or moving or interacting with things like Jar Jar.
I think the only real difference is that Andy Serkis had more technology for his facial acting. They copied that a bit more, which they did get into a bit more when it came to the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, where they talked about how for Davy Jones yeah, specifically, how they a lot of that was actually very practically done. They had to have these mocap suits that were on practical pirate ship sets and had all these tracking points on his face too to create this look. And, you know, that's one of those ones I might just assume was fully done on a green screen, but the pirate ships they're on, all these creatures from the deep sea, it's a real pirate ship they're on, and it's just the actual creatures themselves that are overlaid in CGI, but their performances are all motion captured, and like it's practical acting on practical sets. They just filmed it like they did a normal movie. It wasn't on a giant green screen set with nothing real. It's a very artistic thing, and I liked seeing these behind the scenes I'd never seen before. So Light and Magic season 2 is pretty darn good for film fans. You know, ILM did so many of everybody's favorite movies that I think it's definitely, you definitely need to see it if you're a fan of these behind-the-scenes tidbits, if you want to know how it was all made, right? It's a pretty good documentary. And like I said, I think just a bit more emotionally raw than the first season, but ends too short. And that's it for reviews. Let's get into some news.
Yay, news.
Which, try to get through quickly because it's mostly just trailers. Don't want to hear me talk too much. The first news that's not trailer was I just wanted to acknowledge the passing of Val Kilmer at 65, and excellent actor, iconic, did a lot of great movies over the years. I wish I'd seen more of them. I honestly haven't seen that many Val Kilmer movies.
You can still watch them.
Yep, for sure. I think my favorite ones I've seen are Top Gun and Heat. The best performance I've seen him in is Heat. And I know I see people talking about Tombstone a lot. I'm the loser who's watched Wyatt Earp, but not Tombstone. So I need to see that one. You have a favorite Val Kilmer performance off the top?
Not off the top of my head, no. I can't think of one.
He was Bob Kane's favorite Batman.
He is pretty good as Batman. He's not my favorite Batman, but he's up there.
The co-creator of Batman had Val Kilmer pegged as his favorite Batman. I think he died soon after Batman Forever, but at the time, that was pretty high praise. Too bad he only did one of those. The rest is just trailers here. I'll start with the most disappointing one, which was Tron Ares. Yeah, that one is like, I kind of wanted them to go back to the grid.
Yeah, that threw me off a bit. I don't know.
Tron in the real world, it just feels contrived. I've seen these kind of plots before.
Yeah, that was the unique part about Tron, is it was like,
forget the real world.
Yeah.
The grid is the interesting thing here, and I'm sure they're going to spend a lot of time in the grid. The trailer might just be, I don't know if it's going to be the premise or if they're spoiling the whole third act or something. Like,
or maybe the grid has just changed to look so much like the real world.
That would be a smart play that I don't give them any credit for.
There's no way.
I don't have faith like that. But
I mean, the light bikes didn't even move like light bikes, so that's,
yeah,
that's,
they moved like actual motorcycles.
Yeah.
Some of the effects work was beautiful, though.
It looks good.
It's really good looking. The Tron movies have always been good looking.
I don't know about the first one.
The first one was a pioneer in digital effects. No other movie looks like it. Not a single movie ever made.
But very soon after, the effects work that they did was done better. It may have been one of the first to do it, but the best minds who could have done it probably didn't work on it at the time.
Nobody else has ever made a movie like that. It was so expensive and so painstakingly processed in the way they made that first Tron that nobody else has replicated the way they made that movie.
No.
Nobody else had the time or budget to do it. So maybe you don't like the visual style, but it's still completely unique in cinema history.
It is, yeah. Yeah. No, it's definitely got its place in movie history, but
yeah.
I do know that at the time people thought it looked cool, but it didn't necessarily look good.
I see.
Even at the time.
Tron Legacy looks good though.
Yeah, definitely.
That's the one I didn't even see the original Tron until a couple years ago. But Tron Legacy I watched when it came out. I remember that being a thing. I'll see this one too. Personally, none of the Tron movies are great, but they're all interesting tech demos at the very least. That's really what they're for.
Come on, they didn't even show Tron in the trailer. I'm disappointed.
Tron wasn't even in the second one. I mean, he technically was, but he didn't get any lines.
All right, fair.
Then there was the Naked Gun reboot. Soft reboot, which I haven't seen the original Naked Gun movies, and I know that's a blight on my record because I know I'd love them because I love Airplane and those Leslie Nielsen spoof movies. That comedy's totally up my alley, so I know the Naked Gun, I'd be a big fan of that. But this new one looks funny just as its own thing. The old Naked Gun movies were parodies of cop movies of the 70s. So I agree with the people who say if they can lean into cop tropes of the last decade, that would be more entertaining.
Like the current last decade or?
Just whatever cop media is doing in more recent times. Because the originals were parodies of cop movies and shows.
At the time.
In the 70s and 80s. So you can't keep that same tone exactly and keep to the spirit of the franchise, or at least that's what people who watch it I've heard say. So, like, I can see the very beginning of it looks solid like that with Liam Neeson killing a bunch of bank robbers and stuff in a very, you know, that like Liam Neeson action movie way. But it's just, it starts with him walking into the bank as a, like this little girl walking into the bank, and the SWAT team's like, why is a little girl walking into the bank? And then the little girl rips off a Mission Impossible face mask, and it's just Liam Neeson in this like Girl Scout costume starting to kill bank robbers. And then later on in the trailer, the part that everybody loves is when all the police squad are sitting at altars of their fathers with like frames of pictures of the guys from the original movie, and they're crying at the altars of their fathers. And then there's the one black guy on the squad takes a look at the picture of O.J. Simpson and just shakes his head. He looks at the camera and no. It looks promising as a comedy movie. I haven't seen a comedy movie like that in a very long time, so it could be good. Then there was the Fantastic Four new trailer. I'm digging the vibe on this one. I like that retro futurism 1960s look, and just the fact that the Fantastic Four are already a known quantity and beloved on their world in the multiverse, which is pretty cool. I know a lot of people are upset that the Silver Surfer's a woman in this version, but also it's the multiverse, and I believe somebody somewhere has said that the male Silver Surfer is out there, and he's probably the mainline universe one. It just happens to be a girl in this universe, in this particular movie. The other one, the main one, will show up eventually. But I like the CGI on the thing. It looks like classic Jack Kirby art.
I don't know. I think the like movie we grew up with as kids looked better.
I need personally. It was a practical suit that helps. Yes. I need to rewatch that because I have 20-year-old nostalgia for it. I can't tell you if it was actually as good as I remember as a 7-year-old kid.
Well, I was looking at images just to double check my memory and be like, I was pretty sure it looked better. And it personally, I think it does look better. Like the practical suit looked better.
Yep.
I don't know why they're so averse to practical suits.
Because I guess there's only so much you can do with a practical suit. Like for like emotiveness.
What's wrong with a mix? What's wrong with like doing a practical suit? And like they already kind of do that for stuff. You have your CGI double for when you need the CGI done. But use a practical suit as much as you can. I don't know.
I agree. It should be more of a mix. But, you know, as long as it's like we were talking back before with like facial motion capture. That's easier than putting a mask on him and basically just letting him express with his eyes. It's a lot more stilted. Like even if he had a practical body and neck, but he, like just his face was captured. It just lets the actor act better in this particular instance. I enjoy the casting. I like Vanessa Kirby, Joseph Quinn, Pedro Pascal, and Eben Mosbacherek. They're all good. I expect good things from them. It looks good. I'm excited. And I haven't been excited for a Marvel movie in a while. And then there's the Superman sneak peek, which is basically the same trailer we got before with an extended beginning with that bit when he crashes into the snow and calls crypto. And I know a lot of people are upset by the tone of it, where when he calls crypto, crypto comes running over and then starts jumping all over him. And he's like, just stop and just take me home, crypto. And crypto's just jumping on him.
It's so accurate, though.
Yeah,
that's what a dog would do.
Exactly. And everyone who's complaining about the tone, all the other people say, well, you don't have dogs then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly what a dog would do.
And one of the funniest details from this sneak peek is when he gets brought back to the fortress and you see them taking scans of his body and all the broken bones on his body. And some of them broken bones on the scanner clearly were crypto jumped on him. Just, it's the little details. It's not in your face. It's just like a little, like a x-ray on the bottom corner.
It's not a little dog.
Yeah, on the bottom corner of the screen, just the details.
Yeah.
And you get to see some of the robots from the Fortress of Solitude, and you get to see the Fortress of Solitude and his interaction with some of the robots. And I love how friendly he is, even when he's broken and bloody to a pulp. He still treats these robots with respect and kindness, even though the one guy's like, we're robots, man. Don't worry about it. But he still treats them well, and I like the vibe.
Yeah, I can definitely see that they're going the direction they should be. Like, this is the way Superman should be done.
It has potential to be probably my second favorite Superman movie. I mean, the first one with Christopher Reeve is my third favorite movie of all time. I find it'd be very hard to top that one for me, if only because nostalgia is a very powerful thing. But I can see this one being my second favorite.
Well, sometimes,
pretty quick.
Like, you know, if you're thinking about the next generation going forward, the old Superman movie is becoming unapproachable for them.
Progressively, yeah. It's already unapproachable for a lot of younger people.
It's hard enough, but having a modern version that's even if it's remotely comparable.
Yeah.
At least you know it's carrying some sort of legacy forward, which...
Yeah. And this is the version of Superman that I wish we got to see in the Christopher Reeve movies. Same tone, same kind of thing, but with greater connections to the DC universe at large. You get to see him interact with other heroes and exist in the shared DC universe. Despite, you know, and Henry Cavill gave us that, which is... You know, I really enjoy that version, but tonally speaking, that is not the basis of a universe I ever really wanted to have. I like those movies, but I like the look of this better, just from the trailer. We will review that when that comes out. That is like, I'm going to see that opening day. If I can get a midnight screening or something. I will see that as soon as possible. So, where can we find you?
You can find me on Instagram at jchurchtpm.
And you can find me on Instagram at ThoughtPlane Media. And check out ThoughtPlane.ca for everything else we do. There's hundreds of posts for free on there. And you can donate a buck or two if you like our work and you're feeling generous. We hope to see you on the next close-up with Ryan and Joe, where Justin and I share our mutual passion for the underrated world of audio fiction. Till next time.
Take care.